Ladies and gentlemen, the State Affairs Committee will now come to order. Members, please take your seats and be sure you speak into the microphone during roll call. And with that, Tori, will you please call the roll?
Chair Masulla?
Here.
Representatives Altman? Bartleman?
Here.
Buchanan?
Here.
Chambliss?
Here.
Cheney?
Here.
Drake? Fisher?
Here.
Gia Lombardo?
Here.
Goff Marcil?
Here.
Hardy?
Here.
Hinson?
Here.
Joseph?
Here.
McFarland? Mooney?
Here.
Overdorff?
Yes, ma'am.
Payne?
Here.
Roth?
Here.
Smith C?
Here.
Smith D?
Here.
Stevenson? Toledo?
Here.
Woodson?
Yeah.
Zika?
Here.
Quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Tori. And I want to remind everyone of our House implemented safety rules. Electronic devices, please be sure that you silence your cell phones, including your laptops. And members, if you've watched the Super Bowl, you've seen a new streaming service that had what is called a progressive commercial. And as you watch this commercial, you got really excited about what was going to come next after the next Tampa Bay touchdown. Well, our subject today is also progressive. We're going to talk about sea level rise and flooding in our state. Last week, Chair Buchanan's committee heard about some of the tools that we're using to determine sea level rise and how we might account for resiliency and what we might do with that. Today, we're going to hear from individuals who serve in various roles in addressing sea level rise and flooding in our state. And our plan for our meeting is to allow each presenter to give his or her presentation to the committee. And after all the presentations are completed, we'll recognize members for questions. Please be sure when you're asking a question that you unmute your mic and speak directly into it, because with these masks that we're wearing, often our speech is muddled. First, we'll hear from Noah Valenstein, who is the Secretary of the Department of Environmental Protection and the state's Acting Chief Resilient Officer. Mr. Valenstein, you are recognized.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing us the opportunity to have this presentation this morning. We look forward to discussing this issue, and thank you for the leadership of the House. It's a testament to your leadership that we've already had multiple presentations regarding sea level rise and other impacts of climate change. We appreciate that opportunity and look forward to working with you during session. I will mention, just as a sort of beginning remarks, as the governor came into office, he made several organizational changes to the Department of Environmental Protection and some important appointments as far as staff in Florida. The first was the chief science officer, which is currently Dr. Tom Frazier, who's within the Department of Environmental Protection. And then the next was having a chief resiliency officer for the state of Florida. The first was Dr. Julia Neshwat, and then I currently serve in the interim capacity as the chief resiliency officer for Florida. These two appointments allow us to really drive science into every decision we're making, and they also serve as a sort of a example for all the tremendous scientists that we have within our agencies, that we take data incredibly important and want to make decisions based on data. I'd like to cover a few issues through this, a basic overview of sea level rise, and also some organizational elements within the department, and then current actions we're working on. But I had a few takeaway points that I just want to highlight. First, although one may simplistically think of sea level as a static issue, you know, sea level is X and it stays that way or either goes up or down, it's actually a dynamic issue, and I'll discuss that a little bit. Our work is all based, and certainly Dr. Hirado, who works with the Southeast Florida Climate Compact, will discuss this also. But both the work of the department and the work of local climate compacts is based on physical measurements. It's based on data and projections from that data, but everything comes back to measurements that have been made here, either in Florida or around the world. And in Florida, even small changes are important to recognize. You know, when you look at just within 3 feet of current sea level rise, the amount of dollars and people located here in Florida, a small change in sea level rise can have an immense impact. Lastly, I was going to mention probably the first impact of sea level rise, and I think the thing that's important to talk about why we're doing some of the planning processes we have right now is the first impact would be financial. It's the signal we send to the rest of the world of Florida's open for business. We have a plan. We are sustainable. We are resilient. And when you're thinking about moving your business to a wonderful city like Miami or Pensacola or Jacksonville, you absolutely should, and you should have faith that we have planning apparatus and that we will be resilient and that we should continue to have an economy that grows and communities that are resilient. So the first slide is just talking about various items that impact sea level rise. As I mentioned, instead of thinking of sea level rise as a, or sea level as a static issue, think of it as a dynamic issue. And so you have multiple influences on sea level, some more impactful than others. So going from left to right, changes in everything from groundwater pumping, reservoirs, to runoff, drainage of property can obviously impact water level in the ocean. Subsidence, such as along the Mississippi Delta, so actually lowering of the elevation of the ground can obviously have an impact on mean sea level. And then as we go further right, the more impactful things and the items that are really driving the discussion of sea level rise are water temperature. Obviously, as the temperature of water increases, it expands. And then also the melting of land-based sources of ice. Those two items are the greatest source of sea level rise, and actually the land-based source of ice or land-based ice is becoming a larger portion of sea level rise in recent years. When I was born back in the 70s, those two items between the increasing temperature of water and it expanding and then the melting of land-based sources of ice were probably about equal sources for sea level rise. It's now weighted more heavily towards the melting of land-based sources of ice. Here in Florida, and this is NOAA data that you can take a look at. Again, as I mentioned, and certainly Dr. Hirado and the Southeast Florida Climate Compact do a great job on linking everything back to data. You can go onto NOAA's website and actually look at monitoring points that have a long history here in Florida, over 9 inches in Pensacola since 1923 and 5.25 since 1993. The thing I'd mention about these measurements is they're looking at, and if you go to Key West, we have an even longer data set going back to the early 1900s, and they're linearizing that information. So basically taking the information over time. And again, when you look at sea level, it's going up and down in small increments over the years. And so you're taking that linearized amount, discounting years that it went down, years that went up, and finding that average between them. That is actually a relatively conservative approach. So when you're looking at numbers like this, remember that when you're linearizing that information, you will discount sometimes a more recent, more rapid change of rate with sea level. So sometimes you talk about in instances where you would see 9 inches in Pensacola and you would say, but more recently, if you look at the last 10 years, you've seen a more rapid rate of increase, which isn't necessarily reflected by that data. It's just an important element. This slide is actually, unfortunately, not dynamic, unlike the sea level that I was discussing. If this would play, it would show you one of the key things to remember is we're not just talking about sea level rise. You have to think about sea level rise in conjunction with storm intensification, king tides, high tide events, wave action, all together, those can have increasing impact on Florida. So it's not just the projected sea level rise. That's, you know, we would argue that's not the number you should look at. You should be thinking about that as one element among many that we have to look at for a resilient coastline. So even if you took sea level rise out of the equation, you would still want to talk about intensified storms, what wave action would have as impacts on the coastline, and how to make sure that coastline was resilient to those flooding impacts. And so this would express some of that. So with that all together, you have impacts such as storm surge, more nuisance flooding, habitat both loss of habitat, but habitat squeeze is the idea that when you have greater flooding coming along the coastline and rising sea level, but you already have some sort of barrier, either development or some other geographic barrier, that coastal fringe area becomes compressed. That, such as seagrass beds or coastal marsh, can be incredibly important types of habitat. And you can see that habitat begin to get squeezed between two items, either development and rising sea levels or some other geographic barrier and rising sea levels. Again, the Chief Resiliency Officer was meant to be that point of coordination by the state, again, showing that this is an important issue, that we're taking it on, but also coordinating across a multitude of agencies who work on this. When you think about resilience, it is not an individual bucket, but instead it's a lens that you should look at everything else we do. So when the Department of Transportation is working on transportation projects, there's an element of resilience there. When DEM is looking at response to hurricanes, obviously in making our communities more resilient to hurricanes, there's an element there that you should look at, same as with Department of Environmental Protection. But resilience is more a lens as to what we look at and a little bit of everything we do. So it's not in a single bucket, but should be viewed as additive to all the work of our agencies. And so last year, we appreciate the support of the legislature and the leadership of the legislature in passing Senate Bill 178, which is a sea level impact projection study. And essentially this directs DEP to come up with a tool to look at state finance construction in the coastal building zone and have us analyze the impacts that sea level rise, flooding, storm surge will have on those projects and educate those projects with that information. And so it doesn't cause a change in the project. So if you have a local government in your community who's within that coastal building zone, has a project that maybe you or another member has funded for capital infrastructure, so say a university, and they want to build a new building that's within that area, this wouldn't change their project, but it would request them to go through this analysis so that they could then learn about what the impacts are going to be over various years. And so we'll discuss that a little bit. We're currently having workshops for rural development on this and encourage participation in that. This is just a draft example of what the tool could look like. There are similar tools elsewhere throughout Florida that local governments have done to help visualize for their constituents and businesses what sea level rise impacts could look like. So in this instance, you'd both be able to look at regional scenarios and choose if you look at sort of the blue column in the middle there, you see intermediate high referring to NOAA's projection, that projection, and you'd be able to pick which year you wanted to look at and what inundation there would be projected to be. For the slip analysis, you would be able to go into and find your location of your project on a map, drop the dot, you can see the little create tool report where you'd select the project, give the location, and then start going through basic questions about the design life of the project, its construction elevation, and that would allow us to then populate risk information to help that individual make additional decisions. So you'd be able to see impacts of flooding and storm surge on that project based on its construction elevation, its location in Florida, and then the projected flooding scenarios. Along with that, probably the most important element of this tool, which you won't see yet, again, this is just a draft example, would be alternatives that you could look at. And so you'd be able to actually look through a library of good construction practices in Florida that would address, so if, for instance, wherever you dropped your dot, it said that your base elevation was going to see flooding on X duration over X period, it could then give you examples of probably, you know, near to your community, this is what other individuals have done to make their construction project even more resilient. So here are pre-baked ideas for you to easily implement. Again, you don't have to, but it educates folks further about what impacts they would have on their project and how they could remedy that. Probably the most important thing about this entire process is that this means the state has had to, for the very first time, go through and discuss what its recommended sea level rise projection should be or suite of sea level rise projections should be. Again, compliments to our regional collaborations, again, like the Southeast Florida Climate Compact, who've had to go through this many years ago to discuss, and it's generally a matrix. So you would say, if your design life is 20 years, what should you think about? If your design life is 50 years, if your design life is 100 years, and then you would choose which sea level rise projection curve might most adequately fit that. So they can be as complex as talking about what is the overall capital cost. So if you're building something that's $200,000 and its design life is 15 years, you may choose a different sea level rise projection curve within those options. Because again, this is all risk-based decision making. How much the capital infrastructure is valued, how long you expect it to exist, all play into a risk-based decision about the sea level rise projection. Certainly, the shorter period of time, the more certainty you have to work with sea level rise projections. But we want to make sure we have robust, again, risk-based decision making. Next, I'll move into that sort of reorganizational element of the Department of Environmental Protection. As part of the governor's restructuring of the agency, he created the Office of Resilience and Coastal Protection. And one of the things it did was looking to make sure we've organized areas within the agency so they make sense for your communities and can more easily work with your communities. And so the main thing it did was move our regulatory section for beach and inlet management and put it all under the same office with coral reef protection, our coastal aquatic managed areas, and our coastal resiliency program to make sure you had that synergy that as your community is maybe pulling a permit for either a coastal construction project or a beach renourishment project, but they're also working on their vulnerability analysis or their peril of flood mapping or their adaptation plans for sea level rise, that they can have that conversation all at one time with a similar group of folks working under one roof with one mission. And so again, just I'll briefly flow through these. If you haven't been out to one of our aquatic preserves, they're sort of our state parks of our aquatic resources. There are 42. Again, we appreciate the legislature approving the first one in over a decade last year. For beach and inlet management, I think y'all are familiar with the list of beach projects that come before the legislature each year. It's an important part of making sure, again, Florida is that destination spot around the world for sandy beaches. Coral reef protection is something incredibly important here in Florida. You know, one of our best assets that is not as known as it should be is Florida's coral reef. We've got the third largest barrier reef system in the world, stretching from around Broward County or Martin County, moving south down to Key West. It is an incredibly important asset for Florida, not just for the amount of recreational and commercial species that it supports, for the tourism it supports, but also it's the first line of defense for storm surge coming in and impacting our ocean. If you imagine a healthy coral reef system built up relatively high in the water column acts as a wave break as a storm comes in and has tremendous value for flood protection for Florida. And lastly, we have an initial resiliency program, which the governor's budget this year asked to expand to a resilient Florida program. But the program we have right now focuses on providing smaller grants for communities to assist them in their planning for sea level rise, as well as demonstration projects, knowing that many of the issues your local government has to tackle, such as a stormwater adaptation project, or maybe a green gray infrastructure, working on improving seawalls with mangrove planters, et cetera, the type of project one community has to do is likely gonna have to be replicated elsewhere. And so by us funding demonstration projects, showing how they can be permitted, getting them from point A to point B as quickly as possible, can hopefully make other communities be able to do that even more rapidly in the future. And so just briefly pointing out, we've been funding these for several years throughout Florida, both planning projects, peril flood analyses, and then also actually implementation projects. And these are some examples of those throughout Florida. And with that, I'd open up to any questions.
Thank you, Secretary Valenstein. We're gonna hold questions till the end, so please welcome yourself to relax and enjoy the other two presenters.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Dr. Jennifer Hirado, who is Broward County's Chief Resilient Officer, and today she's presenting the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact. Dr. Hirado, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to participate today. I'm looking for the share content button to be activated on my screen. Okay, and I will get ready to share. And if you could just confirm for me, please, that you can hear me and also see my screen, please.
Yes, we can hear you and we can see your screen.
Perfect. Well, thank you again, Chair Masullo and committee members, for the opportunity to participate and contribute to your discussion today. Secretary Ballenstein provided an excellent overview, and I would just like to reinforce everything that he said. And I'm not going to be so broad in covering many of the points that he made that are clearly very relevant to our communities and in Southeast Florida, but I'm going to give more specific examples of how we've been able to take the regional collaboration of the Southeast Florida Climate Change Compact and focus that effort on resilience initiatives and what they've looked like in Broward County, and then just talk about some of the priorities moving forward and hopefully reinforce the partnership and the importance of the state engagement and the initiatives that you've already endorsed and the continued efforts of DEP and other agencies, which have just been fabulous and very essential to the advancement of work that we've undertaken here in our communities. Secretary Ballenstein outlined some of the kind of global issues, and I'll recognize that in Southeast Florida, we're challenged with a combination of climate impacts. Specifically, most immediate have been those relating to flooding and storm surge. Clearly, we've been challenged with issues of sea level rise for more than a decade. It's just been a very hot topic the last 15 or so years, quite intense. This has been accompanied by a rise in groundwater table, which has exacerbated flooding, and I'll speak to that. We've seen an increase in the intensity of rainfall events, as have many communities in our state. We now talk about 1,000-year rainfall events, and many of us have experience with 20 inches of downpour in less than 72 hours or even 24. More intense storms of longer duration, many of these coupled with high tides and storm surge. So the issues of flooding, while there are many climate impacts that are very dramatic for all of us, I'll be focusing on the implications of flooding most specifically today. And this has many diverse implications for land use considerations and infrastructure planning in our communities, including where we site infrastructure, how we design that infrastructure, revisiting how we integrate drainage and expand these features across the landscape, challenges with regards to the level of service that we can provide for the future, influences for finished floor elevations, which have not accounted for sea level rise, and really rethinking our development strategies. Because this is not an issue or set of challenges unique to any one of our communities, and we found that in Southeast Florida, we were all organizing resources, time, energy, calling upon the same experts for assistance. Now, 11 years ago, we came together as a region to organize on both climate mitigation and adaptation strategies. And this has been a relationship that has endured across transitions in leadership, and it's been a very robust partnership benefiting immensely from the contributions of state, federal, academic, and other partners. Some of the main deliverables that have come from this collaborative are referenced here. I'm going to be emphasizing today, though, the use of the sea level rise projection, but we have a regional action plan. We do have a regional sea level rise projection, which I will share, which we've collectively all used and referenced now for a period of 10 years, although we do update it regularly, and we do that without challenge, and greenhouse gas emissions efforts, reduction efforts. This graphic shows our most recent sea level rise projection, and I would draw your attention to the green area. This is this is the updated projection, which was developed in 2019 and adopted in 2020. Previously, our efforts really targeted the 2060 timeline because most of our planning from a regional standpoint addresses a 50-year planning period. We started working together in 2010, so we were benchmarking a lot of our efforts to 2060, and at that time we were planning for just over 2 feet of sea level rise. We've updated the projection now. This is our third iteration. And in that iteration, we adjusted our 50-year planning horizon now to the 2070 mark. And we most often reference the NOAA intermediate high as the basis for our planning efforts. And today that takes us to a total of 40 inches or 3.3 feet as the basis for planning. And that's relative to the 2000 water levels. So you can see what that adjustment is. I'd like to reinforce the work that is being undertaken with the SLIP study, but also the importance of recognizing that we do have established projections that have been utilized and are currently embedded in our regulations that are also important to have referenced where those are the prevailing standards. But this has very much been an iterative process. We didn't have all the information when we started out, and I won't belabor all the details, but you can just see that we've had to go back and update tools and standards over the years, and we will continue to do so. Just today, our board adopted or advanced the public hearing to adopt the map that is shown here on the right. This is our priority planning area map. It delineates the areas of our county subject to increased risk of flooding now with 3.3 feet of sea level rise. Our previous map referenced 2 feet of sea level rise. And that yellow area on the map is a designated adaptation action area, which is also a kind of resilience planning tool embedded in the State's Growth Management Act and helps to prioritize investments. I won't go into the detail here, but I want to note that it's a tool that we also use. In any event, this map now, when we have a proposed change in land use, we now must view those changes under and in accordance with the projected sea level rise. And this map is also used as a basis for ensuring resilience requirements as part of our own capital planning process. Some of the other work that we've advanced has been now looking at how sea level rise influences our groundwater table. And in 2017, our board adopted a future conditions map series as part of our code of ordinances, and we've now been populating that map series. This first set of maps was informed by our work with the United States Geological Survey and the modeling shown on the left. The area in red shows where the groundwater table responds directly to the change in sea level rise or in sea level. So if sea level rises 1 foot, so too does the groundwater table. And that yellow line is basically where there's a 50% response. But the graphic in the middle actually shows how much change in our groundwater table we've already observed. And in this case, about the last 30 years, I guess, we have various records, but you can see that the groundwater table has been changing and is predicted to continue to change. That affects our drainage infrastructure, our surface water management systems. The graphic on the right bottom shows the modeled change from west to east in a cross-section of Broward County. The former groundwater table is in the dashed line, the modeled future conditions groundwater table in the solid blue, and the brown line shows land elevation. So you can see in the very far eastern of the part of the county, those start to converge, and that means that we lose our drainage capacity in the soils, and it causes us to have to rethink how we, the system requirements for drainage on our developments. And the point being that we were able to successfully bring that to our regulatory process, and now all new development and major redevelopment have to comply with this future conditions groundwater table. After advancing this work, we then partnered with the Army Corps of Engineers, and we modeled the changes that sea level rise combined with high tide and high frequency storm surge would have on our coastal water elevations. And we undertook this work because we were having extensive and continue to have extensive high tide flooding overtopping our seawalls. And we basically had a hodgepodge of elevations and requirements across the county with really little in the way of minimum standards and instead maximums that precluded the ability to adjust and protect against rising sea level. With this work, we were able to establish a recommended top elevation for seawalls, berms, and other barriers of 5 feet NAVD. As a basis of reference, in some areas of the county, the existing infrastructure is just at 1 foot. And there are some nuances here in how this gets implemented. But the long and short is that where we have new construction, major restoration, or where sites are allowing the trespass of floodwaters to adjacent properties, this ordinance kicks in and then requires those improvements. With grant funding from the FDEP, the City of Hollywood was able to advance a major improvement at the marina that was shown here under the Resilience Grant Program. And now this neighborhood is protected from the high tide flooding where it used to just be nearly rapids racing up and through the boat ramp into the community. So really a demonstration of how these types of projects can be elegantly integrated into the landscape with dramatic quality of life and property value benefits. We now have been working on our future conditions flood map. So there are a number of tools that can be used and are used to set finished floor elevations. And in our county, we use a number of tools. They're shown here on the left, but we have a Broward County 100-year flood map distinct from FEMA. FEMA is used for establishing, yes, finished floor elevations, but most immediately critical is it's a measure of risk on a day-by-day basis, and it informs insurance rates. We've been planning for future conditions for some time and establishing higher elevations, trying to ensure that as those FEMA flood maps are adjusted over the years and decades, that our properties continue to be higher than those flood elevations and derive the benefits of discounted flood insurance along with enhanced flood risk. And I won't go into the details, but the graphic on here shows how those elevations have shifted with time. This property was once in an X zone with no flood insurance requirements. It was built at 4.5 feet. And then the next time that the FEMA flood map was updated, the new FEMA elevation was 15 feet in AVD. So now this building, while once, or this home, while once not in a flood zone, is now below the FEMA flood elevation. And this really revealed that we've lost our advantage with our 100-year flood map, and we're now, in some instances, falling below the FEMA flood elevation. And that has major implications, as we can see here with this commercial establishment. And for every foot below FEMA flood elevations, there's basically a 1 foot doubling in the flood insurance costs. And you can see how those rates can very much escalate. And this will be quite problematic as sea levels continue to rise if we haven't prepared for that. For a number of reasons, it's problematic, but the cost of flood insurance and the accessibility of flood insurance is obviously of great criticality for our housing market and the ability to obtain a mortgage. So in the next phase of our work, we partnered with a number of entities, and we had a consultant who supported the work, but we brought in a number of experts to help with some of the analyses. And we ended up modeling a 2 foot rise in sea level, again, coupled with high tides. We also modeled an intensification of rainfall. We went through a very technical process in order to arrive at the factor, but we, in the end, adjusted the rainfall intensity by 13%. And we also modeled supersaturation of the groundwater, indicating no additional opportunity for storage. And we went through a map refinement process, the map shown on the right. The point being that this work was supported with our cities, with our drainage and water control districts, and we're now in the final phases of updating this map, which will provide us with a future conditions flood elevation, our effort to build additional resilience in our systems, and continue to provide support to our residents with regards to flood insurance availability and affordability. There were some questions about our assumptions and those scenarios, that layering in and that compounded flood effect. But I want to reveal that right as we were wrapping up this work, we also experienced Tropical Storm Etta, which was an exact mirror, really, of what we were experiencing, except we weren't yet realizing the same sea level rise scenario, but we had super saturation of the groundwater table. We had four times average rainfall occurring at this time, and it was also sandwiched between high tide events in which we found drainage to be restricted. So it really reinforced the importance of the work that we were taking. And just this last week, we received an endorsement by the League of Cities as we are working for final advancement of that work product. The relevance is shown here. These are just a few examples of looking at both commercial and residential establishments. And that top blue line is the new elevation that will be required for new development and major redevelopment in our county, and it shows that relative to FEMA flood elevations and that overall evolution of those flood planning requirements. So again, the point and effort here trying to be to stay ahead of those FEMA flood maps, reduce flood risk, and protect against losses while providing immediate benefits, which also include flood insurance discounts by through the community rating system, and credits can be earned for those discounts by municipalities and local governments when you plan to higher standards, plan for sea level rise, and there are other relevant categories. Well, these economic arguments haven't been lost in our work with the business community. And now for several years, we've been partnering on the theme of economic resilience, recognizing the immense benefits derived from being able to have a coordinated plan and strategy that I think similar to what Secretary Valenstein was expressing, being able to indicate that we're a good place for an investment. We have a strategy that will continue to support economic vitality, and that we're well organized with actionable initiatives, and we can quantify the benefits of those and provide assurance in the stability of our communities, the marketplace, and the insulation against these other variables absent this type of investment. That led to our working on a study that, again, was also supported by the DEP through the resilience grant efforts, and really want to acknowledge that support. And this has been a study that I think has been widely celebrated, and it's been shared in some of the other committee discussions, I believe. But the point here was really working to quantify not just the exposures, but all the benefits that are derived from coordinated investments in resilience, both focused on individual structures, but also as part of systemic improvements, such as raising seawalls, investing in stormwater plans, beaches, dunes, except I'll say explicitly stormwater investments weren't modeled in the study, but it's the type of a characteristic investment that is also part of those systemic solutions. And what this study revealed was across the region, on average, a 4-to-1 return on investment that comes from building resilience into the individual structures, either raising or wet proofing structures, and a 2-to-1 investment that comes on average in the systemic sort of improvements that protect the whole, like a whole field of infrastructure, such as our roads, our utilities, the entire backside of the community. And there's some ranges in these numbers. Some are higher, as much as 7 or 9, and some are lower. But on average, this is a real reinforcing of the prudence of making those investments. And it relates to preservation of tax base, economic opportunities, jobs, and cascading benefits. The next part of Broward County's plan is now focused on taking those model results and the lessons from all of these evaluations to develop a coordinated countywide resilient infrastructure and redevelopment strategy. I won't go into all of the details, but we're in the procurement for that now. It's going to employ a shared platform utilized across Broward County in collaboration with our state, local government, other planning agencies, so we can holistically look and make investment decisions based upon this evolving landscape and quantified investments needed for water management, storage, and other types of actions. again, this common platform that is intended to provide the basis for multi-decadal investment, tracking of projects, and a quantifiable benefits that can be communicated not only to ourselves, but to these financial markets. But Broward County isn't alone in this type of work. All of our partners are undertaking similar and related initiatives. Monroe County's been aggressively working on a roads improvement project for several years. This has involved elaborate analysis of vulnerabilities and the release of their phase one plan that would address 152 miles of resilience investments, but at a total cost of $1.8 billion. So now we start to look at what are the financial strategies and needs of our communities in implementing the solutions. Palm Beach is working with their municipal partners on an organized vulnerability assessment. Miami-Dade County also has a regional strategy, their 305 strategy involving 34 cities and several projects, high-profile projects with the Army Corps of Engineers focused on the beach and bay. But moving forward, I do want to acknowledge, no matter how robust these efforts are, we have still very significant dependencies, including the Central South Florida Flood Control Project that is managed by the South Florida Water Management District, originally built by the Corps. This system is 60 years old. It has not been redesigned in accordance with the impacts of sea level rise. 18 of our salinity flood control structures are within 6 inches of design failure. That means 6 more inches of sea level rise, and they cannot operate appropriately to support flood protection and water supply. So there's a great need to see the Army Corps undertake that study, and we hope that the state will continue to be a very strong advocate in getting that prioritized now, not in the future. There's lots that needed in the way of budgeting and diverse investments in infrastructure funding, and perhaps most of all, supporting and empowering local governments as we need to explore new and expanded ways of financing projects, which might involve, you know, tax initiatives and other finance mechanisms. So in summary, I'd just like to reinforce again what Secretary Valenstein indicated. Resilience is a shared area of operation affecting all programs and services. We can't defer to just one single entity for that responsibility. No matter how large or small we are, we all need the support from a much broader team than what we have available to us, from technical to financial resources. State and federal agency partners will be critical to our successes. All of our systems are calibrated to these larger projects and state and federal initiatives. Planning and standards are critical, especially accounting for all future conditions, including intensification of rainfall along with sea level rise. And ultimately, the state is and will continue to be a huge partner in the success of these efforts, with diverse funding options that you're able to influence. All areas of infrastructure require that investment. Again, empowering local governments to implement the strategies that we know that we need, and serving as that strong advocate for more active federal partnership, especially as it relates to the Central South Florida Flood Control Project. I thank you for your time, and I look forward to answering questions at the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hirado. We appreciate all the hard work that you and your group have been doing, and please stay tuned for questions after the next presentation. Lastly, members, we have Randy DeShasso, who's the Director of Planning and Research for the Tampa Bay Regional Planning Council. So we're moving from the East Coast now to the West Coast. Mr. Hirado, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members. I'm pleased to be here today, and I will provide an overview of the Regional Planning Council's involvement with sea level rise in the Tampa Bay area. Just as a bit of a background, the council was the first Regional Planning Council established in the state, providing a number of programs to our members across 6 counties. And what we do is we convene the region, elected officials, staff, and the public to give voice to our collective interests. We do this through 3 different basic kinds of ways: research, planning, training, and implementation. And so I'll go through some of these things as it relates to sea level rise. So this is a visualization of what St. Petersburg might look like in 2045 after 2.5 feet of sea level rise and the day after a Cat 3 storm passes by. There's lots of flooding. It's the end of the process of what we currently have about 8 inches of sea level rise since 1946. And the projections that we're using assume sea level rise of about 2.5 feet by 2045 up to 3.5 feet by 2060. This puts a lot of our critical infrastructures under threat. And as you can see here, there's some devastating damage, not just to St. Petersburg, but all up and down our coast. So I'm going to go ahead and talk about how we approach these problems from those three different angles that I mentioned, in economic analysis, some statistical analysis, as well as GIS support for our members and the projects that we work on together. We've also been involved with sea level rise for a pretty long time, producing a study back in 1993 for sea level rise in the Sarasota Bay, and then most recently a new study that will be out in the next few weeks called Taking Stock. And what I'll do is just give you a fairly brief overview of some of the major findings in this study. For starters, we're looking at least $6.5 billion of property that will be 100% inundated by 2060, and roughly the direct loss of about 26,000 jobs in areas that are inundated. There are, of course, much larger effects that ripple out from the loss of that property, but there'll be more of that in the report. The report also looks at some broad economic measures of impact. So a loss of 1.3% of regional gross domestic product by 2050, going up to 1.8% by 2060, and then some impacts on local sales tax and property tax revenue, both by 2060. One thing I would mention here is that when we do our studies, we like to benchmark them against other studies. So the Congressional Budget Office Research Division does a lot of good work on economic analysis. And they have a study that's recently out on impacts to the U.S. economy by 2050 from climate change. And they're estimating an impact of about a loss of 1% to the gross domestic product. And so we feel that this is within an acceptable range, and it's potentially quite realistic because Florida may be experiencing greater impacts than other parts of the country. The report will also include heat impacts, 5,000 above trend deaths a year statewide, as well as impacts to pavement, and then some critical transportation improvements, up to $7 billion, actually. And I'll talk about that in a little bit, where we came to that. So the report will include some maps of anticipated sea level rise by 2045 and 2060. And you can see that the damage just in these three areas is pretty extensive. There are other maps coming, of course. But the thing that I wanted to come back to is that, of course, at a certain point, the research is the rubber that has to meet the road. In this case, we worked with the three large metropolitan planning organizations in the Tampa Bay area on one of 11 studies around the country funded by the Federal Highway Administration to look at the impact of sea level rise and extreme weather on transportation infrastructures. So working with the MPOs, we developed an analysis of critical transportation assets, and then modeled sea level rise and extreme weather events against those assets, a Category 3 storm and a 9-inch rain event, and then looked at how those roadways were impacted, and then looked at how that changed the regional transportation picture, and from there, the economic impacts of all of those things. By doing so, we were able to develop a benefit cost analysis of what the impacts to the economy would be, and then the avoided costs of those impacts, and then to work together on identifying a package of of projects that would mitigate those circumstances. And those have been adopted into each of the long-range transportation plans of the MPOs. So that is a case where we're moving towards programming those resiliency kinds of infrastructure improvements based on the research that we do. And of course, we have a broader perspective on planning too, that we look at a wide range of issues that are important to our members. But one of the things that I thought would be really important to mention here is that our perspective is not just metropolitan or across a wider geographic area. We also work with our local jurisdictions. For example, Newport Richey asked us to come and help them rethink its flood-prone downtown area in terms of how it might be redeveloped in the future using CRA funds. And so we did that, and we looked at various kinds of urban design concepts, adaptation measures, elevated buildings, passive recreation, those kinds of measures to help the city revitalize its downtown, but also to make it more resilient to climate change. And of course, coming back out to a more regional perspective, we established a resiliency coalition back in October of 2019. There are some 29 local jurisdictions in our area, 6 counties and 21 cities within our area, and then a few participating jurisdictions from Sarasota County. We're all working together to produce a regional action plan. Regional action plan really builds upon the work that we set forth in the regional leadership summit that we conducted back at the beginning of January 2020 with over 300 participants to help shape and put together the basic concepts that will eventually come together as the regional action plan. So that effort continues to this day, mostly online through various platforms, social media platforms to help bring the region together. And then hopefully when we're all more mobile, we'll get back out to our local jurisdictions to talk about how we can complete our first regional action plan for the region on this issue. And then one of the other things that I think is also really important is our REACH effort. This is our timeline. Currently, the summit is planned for July, August time frame, but we may be pushing that out towards later in the year. And then I'm sorry, I'll come back to the REACH as well. That stands for Resiliency and Energy Assessments of Communities and Housing. And what this is focusing on a really key issue that we see in our economic analysis is that a lot of low-income neighborhoods be especially impacted by sea level rise. The idea is to help our local jurisdictions put together vulnerability assessments of those communities and to ultimately provide a self-assessment checklist for those local governments to help them think through the various planning challenges they face and planning for sea level rise with respect to housing and low-income needs as well. And then wrapping up, another feature that we work on is implementation and training. Here I'll just go ahead and jump to our conclusion so we can get to questions. But we've done a lot of work in terms of getting out to our members and developing applications on storm surge and evacuation studies. And we've used these developments to, again, provide information to our partners, not just within the region, but across the state. And so with that, I will say thank you, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. DeShazzo. Members, we're open for questions. Any questions for any of the three presenters? Rep. Cheney, you're recognized.
My question is for Secretary Valenstein. So So, hi, how are you? And I thank you for the time you've taken with me on the phone in the past. To remind you, I'm from South Pinellas Beaches, so next to Miami and Key West, we're kind of ground zero for everything you're discussing. And do I understand correctly that the budget includes $65.5 million, that's the governor's recommended budget, and is that for to be pushed down to communities to implement some of these strategies, or is that more research and reporting, that sort of thing?
You're recognized.
And is the microphone on?
Yeah, got it. It's on now.
Thank you. I think resilience is in a little bit of everything we do. So I'll talk directly about the governor's Resilient Florida program, which was $1 billion over 4 years, which is what he announced in his Florida Leads budget. And so that $1 billion over 4 years, the first year of that, and the budget that the legislature will be working on this session, includes $165 million in bonded revenue that would go towards grants for critical state assets in local communities for the cost of the impact of sea level rise on those assets. It also includes more than $10 million for planning, and that's part of the cash revenue, not the bonded amount. They would go towards ensuring, you know, of the 211 coastal communities we have between counties and municipalities, about 123 of those have already worked to have some level of peril, flood, or vulnerability analysis done, in large part supported from the department's program already. One of our key messages, again, is the most important thing we can be doing as a state right now is ensuring that all our communities are at the same level of planning. Certainly when you hear from Dr. Hirado and even Tampa Bay, you've got a relatively sophisticated analysis for their communities. Certainly St. Pete has done a tremendous job analyzing their risks. Not everywhere in Florida is there. We need to be there as soon as possible and need to be at 100%. So that about $10.1 million allows us to hand out more than $100,000 grant for each of the remaining communities to make sure that we're getting that planning done. And importantly, to make sure that each community's local plan, whether it's a peril of flood, vulnerability plan, or if they already have that and they're looking at an adaptation or some combination thereof, that it's being done in a way that we can aggregate them as a state to get information that's useful for us, and also that we're sort of getting more out of it than just the basic vulnerability plan. And so that's the large part. In addition to that, we still have our Office of Resilience and Coastal Protection within DEP, obviously that we mentioned that does a large number of things with resilience, including our coral program and others. And then there still remains a number of programs, whether it's at DEO, DEM, DOT, that deal with resilience. But certainly $1 billion over 4 years is a significant investment that shows we're racing towards the finish line on planning, but the state with the governor's leadership is already ready to look at how do we take those plans and with state assistance help local governments put them to action.
Rep Roth, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm not sure who to address this to. Mr. Valenstein, you're at the desk, so maybe I'll address it to you. In listening to the presentations today, we had had different analysis of where we would be at 2060. One of them was, you know, the IPCC median plan, where it said by 2060 you would be at 27 inches, where the gentleman from Tampa talked about being at 42 inches. So what my concern is, and let me try to make this short, but I got to say it, I want to be a little bit of a critic to this new process, in resiliency process. I think the whole concept, what we did last year, was awesome. But my question to you is, how do we really truly provide a balanced approach? My concern is, as a conservative and an agriculturalist who follows the weather by the minute and understands that we have had higher nighttime temperatures the last 10 years. Thank God we haven't had as many freezes. That's money in my pocket. But we haven't had the higher daytime temperatures. So there is things going on. But as we focus on resiliency, my concern, and here's my question, my concern is that we don't overplay our hand and make everybody think, you know, that A, that Florida is in real disastrous trouble in the next 10 years. How do we get, are we going to have a scientist or someone as part of this resiliency that can help us better understand what really is going on? Because there's just different models as to how much the sea level will rise over the next 40 years. Are we having, we're going to really focus on trying to have a better projection?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, great question. And I'm actually looking at one of the slides that Dr. Hirado had up, and this is the reason why I mentioned you shouldn't think about sea level rise in one particular number, right? One, recognizing that sea level in itself is not a static, but it's a fluctuating trend. Two, when you're looking at projections, you shouldn't look at just one projection. Again, at the very heart of it, this is about making smart decisions and good planning. And from that, it's a risk-based decision-making. And so with that, there are a number of parameters that should go into it. As I mentioned before, what infrastructure are you talking about? What does it cost? What is its built life? And then what risk does it make sense to put into that? And so you absolutely, I certainly believe, shouldn't look at one number in making those determinations. And so I would say on the state side, as I mentioned, when we're going through the rule development for our SLIP tool, one of the most important things we'll be doing is very similar to what Jennifer pointed out on the slide where you had the matrix with IPCC, the NOAA Intermediate High and the NOAA High, and it shows year ranges, but for each of those, is that we as a state should be setting the example of, okay, here's our recommended matrix of how you look at the cost of the infrastructure, the built life of that infrastructure, and then multiple risk curves, and then how you intersect those in good planning decisions. And unfortunately, that's not so simple as saying, here's one number. But to your point, if you say that, I think you then have questions saying, well, does that mean these other numbers are wrong? And certainly there's uncertainty with all of it. The important part, again, is looking at a matrix for good risk-based decision-making. So I think you're hitting the nail on the head, and that's why you'd see the focus on that from the state. And frankly, from other communities that have done it, just as Jennifer mentioned, I think her slide speaks to your point of looking at more than one piece of information at once and always being able to draw it back to what is the actual physical real-life measurement that we've had to date.
Rep. Roffey, you're recognized for one quick follow-up, and then.
Thank you, Secretary. My concern again is, with as I've watched this climate change scenario, particularly as it relates to universities, University of Florida, getting grants for doing climate change projections and all that kind of stuff, what you see is there's more value to entities to project a bigger change. And so what my concern is, from a conservative standpoint, that we use this resiliency office to try to do our own analysis. I'm not kind of like WHO and health. I don't really want to rely too much on the United Nations. So that's where I'm hoping you're going to go, is to give us some good, you know, do your best job to try to give us some decent projections. Thank you.
I guess there wasn't a question there. Ranking Member Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Secretary Valenstein, for your presentation. I wanted to ask you about the SLIP study and the SLIP studies that you talked about in the presentation. I know that you mentioned that there doesn't appear to be compliance requirements with the recommendations of the SLIP study. So my question is that do you see at some point in the future that our state would be ready to require the implementations or the recommendations on the SLIP study in the construction recommendations that they're making? Because right now, my understanding is they're not required to comply with those recommendations in those coastal areas.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative, I think the first thing I would say is I would look at them as alternatives, not necessarily recommendations. And so there is compliance in the sense that if you are within the jurisdictional bounds of that legislation, and therefore, once the rule is active, again, we're aiming to get to that point later this year, then you have to go through the process and end up with that completed report. There's compliance to make sure that you actually get to that point. But to your point, it doesn't force you to adopt one of those alternatives that's listed or change the construction. That is the bill is written and that is statute. I think there is a tremendous amount of use from a public education from that, but also very important, you know, as important as educating the public and educating those investing in those projects is educating us, both at the agency and the legislature, on what are the impacts? How are our built infrastructure that we're investing in, or how is the built infrastructure that the legislature and our agencies are investing in going to withstand future sea level rise? What is that analysis? So that's part of what the bill actually does, is get a data set for all of us to look at as to where state money is going in that coastal area. And from that, I then think we would all be in a position to make future decisions based off that. Right now, I don't know that we have as robust enough data set to do that. I think that's actually one of the very points of the legislation.
You're recognized for follow-up, ranking member.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the answer, Secretary. I appreciate that, especially as we're, you know, getting many of the results of the SLIP study, and you know, we need to understand its impacts. You know, I would suggest that as we receive that and as we plan for the future, perhaps we, to protect our taxpayer investments in some of these coastal construction projects, that we require some kind of compliance or consider it. My next question was related to the Chief Resiliency Officer. I know that you've had to step in, that DEP has had to step in to essentially play that role that was intended to be for someone who had to leave their position. Do you think that it makes sense for our first Chief Resiliency Officer to perhaps be separate from any specific agency, to be separate and independent so that they can focus on all aspects of sea level rise, whether they be economic, related to infrastructure, or related to environmental impacts to be considered?
You're recognized. Sure. Answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, so first thing I would say is I wouldn't say have to step in. I'd say we got to step in. It's a tremendous honor, both for myself and the agency, to get to serve as Chief Resiliency Officer. It's something that our agency enjoys working on and takes very seriously. We have Alex Reed, who's the Director for our Office of Resilience and Coastal Protection, here today. It's an issue that we, as an agency, work on every day, and it's a large part of our portfolio, so it's very easy for us to have this position for the time being or permanently within our agency. I think when you look across states, you see multiple ways that it has been implemented where there are other Chief Resiliency Officers or positions with the functional equivalent type of duties. We look to be effective that. We look to serve the governor. We very much appreciate the governor has put a spotlight on how important this issue is providing significant resources and making sure we're moving forward swiftly as a state. And again, just to sort of directly answer your question, I think from looking across other states, it functions well in a multitude of organizational ways.
Rep Hardy, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Valenstein, or rather Secretary Valenstein, sometimes projects are built with money that might not be funded by the state, but with money that comes through the state's hands. And that is meant to be spent here in the state of Florida for the people of Florida. And the SLIP tool isn't really meant to address projects financed in that way unless state funds are kind of mixed with that. In your opinion, based on your expertise, should there be a consideration for projects like that that are funded with funds that are administered by the state of Florida?
Mr. Chair? Mr. Secretary.
That's a good question, Representative. I think I would answer it in this way. Our intent in both the workshops we had with a wide variety of stakeholders and our workshops for rulemaking, as we continue rulemaking, are meant to build as robust a tool as possible that can be used regardless as to whether or not you fit within the jurisdictional boundaries of the statute. And so, frankly, we hope with the investment we're making in this that whether or not you have to go through this analysis, that it is a robust tool that is there and available for you to use regardless. And we would look forward to working with the legislature if there are other areas, if there are other geographic areas or types of projects that the legislature feels like should go through that process. Our goal right now is building a tool that would actually be able to serve everyone regardless as to whether they have to go through it.
Thank you.
And you're recognized for follow-up, Rep. Hardy.
Thank you. My follow-up is actually for Dr. Harada.
Hi.
Hi, thank you. So first off, I could tell from how thorough and complete your presentation was that you were a University of Miami Hurricane. So I very much appreciate the great job that you did there. I had a question about the rising water table. There's been some speculation that sea level rise is something that's going to affect primarily coastal communities, and that communities that lie a little more inland won't be affected, and that I think some of the speculation is meant to license the perspective that, you know what, maybe it's not that big a deal because we've got a lot of unused land inland. Can you talk to me about how sea level rise and the rising water table will affect all people, not just folks who live in directly coastal areas, but folks who might live a little more inland?
You're recognized, Dr. Rado.
Thank you, sir. I'm glad to. First of all, I'm obviously most familiar with the work in our region, but from our analyses, we see the impacts of the rising groundwater table about 6 miles inland. And so there are implications for overall drainage and water management well set back from the coast. It's possible in some areas of the state that would be more variable, but what I can speak to is that in our region, we see that signal as far as 6 miles inland. But perhaps more profound is that even our most western municipalities, such as Miramar, Weston, large areas of Pembroke Pines, we found in some of the more recent analyses and in what's happening during these rainfall events, that during the extreme high tides, that there is a dramatic signal of rising water levels through the entire system of the canals that are required for stormwater and management and stormwater discharges that affects water management operations across the entire county. That is reinforced by recent modeling performed by FEMA as part of the coastal A-zone modeling, where we saw large tracts of Broward County in the most western areas that are seeing this cascading elevation in those water stages. And so whether you're in Broward County or elsewhere, where we have these dependencies on coastal discharges for flood protection, those end up being hampered. And I know that in analyses that were undertaken by water management districts across the state, all of the water management districts had evaluated impacts of sea level rise on those salinity control structures, on their ability to protect against storm surge. And we also haven't talked about water supply. All of our coastal well fields and water sources are vulnerable to saltwater intrusion. So that's another critical area. Those salinity control structures protect our water supply, and they need to be evaluated for impacts of rising seas, not on just drainage and flood protection, but water supply availability. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Rep. Henson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. She answered some of my question, especially the one about saltwater intrusion. Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, we spent a lot of money apparently on these studies, And the results are quite impressive, at least to me, because they've actually gotten to observe what they predict is going to happen, almost happens. So we need to start preparing more proactively, in my opinion. My question is, if we are not doing anything with code enforcement and construction, what's the point? And so my next question is, what are we doing proactively to make our communities more resilient, such as maybe sea walls, or I know in Louisiana they have sea levees, or are we requiring homes, maybe even current homes, to start being elevated? We've spent a lot of money on these studies. What are we doing, Mr. Chair, to make our communities more resilient?
Rep. Henson, is your question to me?
I just saw House rules. I'm supposed to go through you.
Yeah,
it's really to him.
To Secretary Valenstein.
Yes.
Yes, you're recognized to answer those three questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, appreciate the question. And I'll actually probably in part punt to Dr. Hirado, but I would start by saying this legislature has got a long history of very proactive planning practices and also regulations through our water management districts and through the state that address flooding and impacts from flooding, coastal construction, all of which are meant to make sure we've got a resilient, resilient communities and growth practices in Florida. Now, a lot of the work, as Dr. Otto mentioned, was making sure that we have the data that feeds into that such that if those flood projections aren't accurate anymore, you know, as Dr. Otto talked about for a while, saying and actually showed structures where you had a year where the flood elevation for 100 years was at X elevation and then shortly thereafter was revised. The question is making sure we've got thorough enough analysis that allows those regulations to take into account what we actually see occurring now or projecting to occur. And so with that, you see also local governments with their own ordinances coming in and directing just as they would for any number of growth practices, construction practices, and the like. And so I think there's, as with many things in government, multiple layers there, but we certainly have enforceable regulations aimed at protecting properties from flooding and construction. Again, the question is, we need to get as quickly as we can to robust planning so we can adapt as the world is adapting around us, and those regulations are reflecting the reality that we see today and are projecting for the future.
Okay, thank you. Representative Overdorf, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have a statement and two questions, if I can. First of all, the statement, Mr. DeShazo, I think that the regional planning councils are certainly uniquely qualified and positioned to be able to be an asset in sea level rise planning. I absolutely agree with that. I think that's, you cross so many county lines and have an idea on not only dealing with the agencies, but also with local government. So I think that's a fantastic use of regional planning councils, and I certainly support that. On a couple other items, and this can be answered by any of the panelists, please. We heard a projection and a statement that sea level has risen 8 inches since 1946, yet over the next 24 years, we're looking at a 3.5-foot rise. In other words, an 800% acceleration of rise. And I obviously that's concerning. The projection itself is concerning. Knowing that the Panorama Tower, for instance, in Miami, is an 84-story tower built on basically calcium carbonate areas that aren't meant to handle an 84-story building, the largest in Florida, on Brickell Avenue. Wondering if anybody is also looking at the area of sinking and the weight that's associated with that and how material actually might be going down a little bit, not just sea level rising on our coastal areas. If you could comment, anybody.
I'd like to just refer back to the point in my slide when I talked about the dramatic increase in sea level rise. So that estimate is based on the NOAA high curve. That is one perspective that we're taking on the issue, is what is the worst case scenario, precisely because of what Secretary Valenstein referred to as being able to think about what's at risk and to be able to map out the various risks that we face. There is a concurrent study being undertaken by the Tampa Bay Partnership, using the same consultants done for the business case study in Southeast Florida, who are looking at a more modest sea level rise projection. And so we're working with them on that. And what I'm hoping to get out of that process is a much more textured look at what the potential risks are and under various scenarios. So with that, I'll just pass on your question to the other panelists.
Representative Valenstein, you're recognized. And then Dr. Hirado also after you.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, again, I think very good question. Similar to Representative Ross' question, my response would be that you should always look at, one, the actual data, physically measured data. So what have we seen in tide gauges throughout Florida? We've got that and have a long history of it. Likewise, recognize that data regarding ice melt, ocean temperature is physically measured data. We've got real world data and should always start with that and then understand how projections are built off of that. And so I agree, you should always look at a matrix and not jump to, hey, this is the one curve, we should only talk about this projection. To make good choices, I think you always have to go back to what's the data raw that we have measured, and then how are we getting projections from that, and then what are the various projections, and then make risk analysis from that. And then to your point about settlement, certainly NOAA and other institutes have in their projection for sea level rise reflect settlement in it. So I'm happy to follow up with afterwards. One of my slides, I think it was the second slide in, used a NOAA graphic with arrows going up, and it's either green or yellow or red, showing various tidal stations where there's a long history of measurement of the sea level. And if you look over, if you took that graphic online and were able to pan out and moved over towards the Mississippi Delta, you'd actually see those arrows red on the NOAA map. And that's actually a reflection of a higher sea level rise, in part due to coastal subsidence there in the Delta. And so subsidence is something that is certainly being looked at. You raise a good point. And I think I would end the response there.
Thank you.
Members, we only have 8 minutes left, so if we can keep it very brief. Rep. Overdorf, quickly, and then we have a few other people that want to ask some questions.
Last question is just a quick question on, I know we've talked a lot about hardening and things along those lines, but would like to talk a little bit about the Blue Carbon Initiative and looking at seagrass, mangroves, et cetera, as an opportunity to have a carbon sink as a natural way of combating what we're seeing in the world. And obviously, Florida is uniquely set up for that. So if you could just maybe comment on that. And Dr. Hirado, I know you had waited to make a comment before, but thank you, Chairman. That was my question on blue carbon.
You're recognized.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I wasn't sure whether that was directed at Dr. Hirado or not. My brief response is, as Representative, certainly we're tracking some of the federal work on that right now. Any opportunity to highlight the natural resources Florida has and has done a good job stewarding and protecting, and the ecosystem services that come from those resources, is something we welcome. As far as, I don't know if you mean the particular legislative initiative federally at the moment, that's something we're monitoring. Would be happy to follow up with you.
Thank you.
Rep. Murphy, you're recognized. Go ahead. Rep. Stevenson, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chair Missoula. Secretary Valenstein, I had a question about ecological flowways, and if we can, which was kind of under our Greenways and Blueways plan 20 years ago or so, we had ecological flowways that would connect some of our large natural areas and help with issues like long-term, like drainage type issues. Flowways were one of the, I think they call them ecological greenways or flowways. Do we have enough emphasis on those important connectors, considering the changing environment.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I think what you're referring to is as one of the basis of Florida's land acquisition program, and we've had a long and strong history of conserving property here in Florida. The underlying analysis, a lot of it done by Dr. Hochter at University of Florida and others, about key green infrastructure linkages, both important for habitat, for species to be able to survive long-term in Florida. Because again, it's one thing to protect 100,000 acres. If it's all in 5,000 acre increments, you end up having habitat fragmentation. You don't have the value to species like Florida panther or black bear. So having those large connections and the ability for species to move are also likewise important for groundwater recharge, functioning flood protection for communities. Likewise, certainly today we realize the value wetlands play for Florida and do a great job protecting them. So I think that the focus you're mentioning sits right now within the Florida Forever program. I think we're doing a really good job now picking up properties to make sure we have that green infrastructure working both fee simple and easement, especially in rural areas, recognizing the value that our rural lands play as part of that. And we work in coordination with the water management districts to help identify areas for protection, in part for water resource protection. So yes, that is there.
So thank you. I didn't know if it needed to be re-evaluated, but I appreciate your saying that it seems well. The other thing that I was concerned about is subsidence, if I may. I don't know how many people are.
Very briefly, we have two other people that want to ask questions. We have
so one of the things I'm hearing is that some of our natural protections that might help with holding land is not able to adapt to the sea level rise that we're currently projecting. And that's a concern, the sinking part. And I don't know if acidification of the oceans has anything to do with the subsidence, if that's being considered. And that's all I will leave with that.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Certainly, again, that ecosystem squeeze where you've got sea level rise pushing up against development, something we look at. We've got three National Estuarine Research Reserves, again, under the Office of Coastal Protection and Resilience. So they actually have studies ongoing about, for instance, ecosystem squeeze on salt marsh. And then as far as ocean acidification and rising temperatures of the ocean, certainly impact our coral. And that is something that our coral section of that office is monitoring.
Rep. Mooney, you're recognized for a very quick, brief question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Secretary, you said early on that you're now going to have a number of agencies under one umbrella to help streamline any process. So being from Monroe County, we are shovel-ready in a number of areas. We had one neighborhood last year, 100 days underwater, could not get to their houses. So we're prepared and ready. But the question is, with that said, is there internal discussion about how you're going to relax some of the environmental regulations that exist? Because if you don't do that, we will not get things done at any level, because there's not a one-size-fits-all in this entire state. But people who are ready and who have done the resiliency understand the mitigation and the resiliency part of it. Is there a plan in place to relax some of the codes? Because if not, I don't know how you're going to use green recovery and use all these multiple areas to fix the problem and, well, to mitigate the problem, not fix it, but to mitigate it.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the words relax environmental protections are never coming out my mouth as Secretary for the Department of Environmental Protection. And it's not something that I've seen the need or had a request for as it relates to resilience. But maybe I think the area that you may be discussing for the Keys and elsewhere in Florida is there are new innovative solutions for, instead of just building a seawall, looking at a living shoreline and the value of a living shoreline. We recognize now, much more so than we did years ago, yet our permitting process was built around a hardened shoreline, just putting in a seawall. And so although it's counterintuitive, building a natural living shoreline hadn't been done as much, and so the permitting process certainly, I've heard, was more laborious, even though that is absolutely something that's positive for the environment we would want to see more of. In that instance, yes, we've got multiple collaboratives working to ensure, and again, as I mentioned, within our current grant program, part of the thing we were doing is paying for and helping put out grants for example projects. Living shorelines is one. We would like both to help fund some of those and also demonstrate that we can get them quickly through the permitting process, because we want to see positive projects just like that. So, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Members, we're going to have to stop our questions. And Rep. Woodson, I'm sorry we didn't get to you. You'll be first on the list next time. I want to thank all the presenters for their time today. And I had a brief discussion with Ranking Member Smith earlier before we started our meeting. These presentations bring up a lot of good points for all of us to take note of, particularly the fact that we need to have confidence in the models we create and the data we use to make sure that people that implement these changes across our state are doing so with real numbers. And I think that's something that we're going to have to address not only today, but in the future. And with that, Rep. Drake, move we rise, and we are adjourned. Right on time.